Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9:00 AM on April 22nd, 2025. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County DUP or Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commissions. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Alvarado Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. So I am going to say the flag salute and on you're all welcome to join me if you'd like.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the door. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changed to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Thank you. Comments from the public is item two on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and person shall be recognized to speak from sign-up cards located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star nine if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you have used a phone to call in, you'll need to dial star six to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk. We'll distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with all our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So we'll start out item one, recognition. Our General Manager's Life-Saving Award, Cameron Nixon and Cole Ricardo. And Paul Kiss is going to introduce them.
Sounds good.
Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Commissioners. Paul Kiss, Operations Superintendent out of the Op Center. So very blessed and pleased to be here to present Cam Nixon and Cole Ricardo. Have you guys heard the whole story or do you want to hear the... Okay, perfect. I'll try to keep it short. So Cam and Cole driving down in a bucket truck. They had a project over off of outside Edmonds there. Going down the road, heading out to a job site. They're going to be heading out to some double circuit, put some spacers up on the line, keeps the phases from slapping together and knocking the circuit out. So they're going along in the bucket truck. The foreman was behind them a couple minutes. As they're cruising down the road, they're headed to the next location. They saw some smoke kind of billowing up from a parking lot out in front of them there. So they got to looking at it, thinking, oh, what the heck is this? And as they got closer and closer, they recognized that there was a motorhome that was on fire. Smoke was coming outside of the windows and the doors and everything. So they swung down, looped back in into the parking lot. And that time, started to see some flames and stuff coming out of it. Someone jumped out of the motorhome, an individual jumped out and started running down the road. And as he got out, he said, oh, there's two more people inside of the motorhome. So the guys parked the truck, hit the brakes, jumped out, jumped into action right away, got a hold of their foreman, which is right behind him. He got a hold of 911 and said, hey, we're at this location. We're stopping by. We've got a situation with the motorhome. They ran up to the door and beat on it. Opened it up. As they're opening up, of course, more and more smoke and flames are coming out of the door and started yelling inside of the motorhome of, is anyone in here? Anyone conscious? Whatever, right? And as they look in, there no response from anyone. They looked in, they saw two legs poking out, kind of right up in the door of the motorhome. Shook and shout, no response at all. Tried to tug on the legs, couldn't get that person out as a female. They recognized a whole bunch of stuff in there and they couldn't get the person out. They're all lodged in there. So they climbed into the motorhome. Granted, this thing's on fire and smoking, right? And got all the boxes and all the junk out of the way. We're able to pull the lady out of the motorhome and carry her to the ground outside of the motorhome. And at that point, you know, the thing's engulfed, like the flames are shooting out of it there. So they didn't go any further into the motorhome to even try to find the other person that was there or not. And that time, the foreman had rolled up and the fire department was close by. So they showed up just about the time the guys are getting the lady out onto the ground. Fire department showed up. They started doing life-saving measures with the, you know, the first aid and the CPR and all that. They were able to get the lady back to life. Very burnt. I'm going to get graphic about it, but burnt from head to toe. These guys went through a lot and saw a lot through this whole situation. But anyway, they got the lady to Harborview. Lived for several more days after that. All the family got to come and see her, but definitely a huge, as you can imagine, huge heroic event, right? We talk about safety, we talk about watching out for each other and helping everyone all the time, right? But it's just, are we really prepared? Are we prepared for those type of situations? We all think, oh, I'll be the hero and jump in, right? But like these two individuals did, right? It was a very selfless act. They jumped in, they took care of themselves as far as PPE and all that, but jumped into that line of fire and tried to help this customer and did, right? Who survived her life for a few more days there. So huge event. That afternoon, we with Gregory's took him to the hospital and got checked out. They had a fair amount of smoke, you know, nasty smoke inhalation, as you can imagine, from all the toxins from that. They checked out good. They're still looking good today, so they survived that very well. But just awesome, right? Just, you know, two apprentices that just jumped in. You can't train, you can't prepare for it, right? You can have a zillion classes and never be prepared for a situation like that. And these two individuals just jumped in without a misstep at all, got the proper authorities coming. So we're just extremely proud of these two. And it just, I pray that I would have that same motivation and that same drive in that situation. And that's what we hope for all our individuals here at the district. So definitely
There are always
amazing.
lives at risk.
100%.
That is something.
So,
Yeah.
So I see you didn't get the memo. It was dress up day.
It was better than normal, John. So, yeah.
Honored to be able to recognize you two again, Cam and Cole, for what you did. Again, true spirit of what we are as Team PUD, and you two sacrifice yourself, huge courageous act, true heroes. And it's again our honor and pleasure to recognize you for what you've done and with the DM life-saving award. Appreciate you guys.
You guys.
Plus, I do take a little pride in embarrassing
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
You're both
Thank
great.
You.
Sisters, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Wow, we got lucky. We got some good ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anytime someone receives an award, they have the opportunity to speak at the microphone. If there's anything you want to say, I let Paul tell a story for you. Okay.
Paul did a really good
job. Good job. Really. I said you put your lives at risk.
Yeah,
you
did.
And when he was coming out, you didn't know what was in that trailer.
And you gave that woman a chance. So,
yeah, one of the coolest things was,
amazing.
And I think Paul touched on this, is the family had approached Cam and Cole and said that through their actions and their bravery, they were able to say goodbye to their relative. So, hugely meaningful to a lot of folks. So, yeah, and super proud of you guys.
Who are we?
Thank you. I'm sorry, what did you say?
One photo with them.
Oh, photo?
Yeah, got you a photo.
You can go ahead.
I'll be over here.
I speak a lot that you hear. There you go.
I'll carry in a pinch, Aaron.
I'm not a professional. All right, there we go. Thank you.
Thank you. Don't be embarrassed. I know you don't really want to stay for the
meeting. Yeah.
Thank you
very
much.
He wanted to say something,
no.
And
I did.
I started applause, and sorry to cut you off.
And Commissioner, when I was in our daily newsletter that April 14th, 18th was Lineman's Appreciation.
Right.
So kudos to that.
All right. Next, item two, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on item not on today's agenda? Please state your first and last name for the record. Let's see any hands up in the room, but we have Gayla Schumann hand up in the audience. Unmute. Good morning, Gayla. You're muted, it looks like. If you can unmute. You're still muted. Yeah, if you wish to speak, you'll need to unmute. Okay, well, it seems like I'm not going to be able to unmute, so we'll continue on. Next is item three, our consent agenda. 3A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of April 8th, 2025. 3B, bid award for professional service contracts and amendments. And 3C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Raise your hand. Not seeing any hands up online. Any questions from you, commissioners?
I should know this, but on steel casings for Crosswinds transmission project, is the explanation of the process for this amendment within the bounds of RCW? Okay, so this could be any amount of money. And the contract is written such that, or is this standard OP? No, they.
Hello, sorry. Hope Linder, contracts and purchasing. Yes, the steel casing, that was a RFP that was done, and they did the full evaluations and then awarded the contract.
Okay, but this speaks to amendments. It says the staff may be adjusting pricing, which I understand.
Oh,
that's reality. But my question was, if it goes over statutory amendments, does that include this? Like an amendment?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
I have a general question. So I've noticed, you know, after the pandemic went through a lot of inflation, our estimates were coming in below cost. And now estimates seem to be higher than the actual cost. Several of these things, this steel casing one is an extreme example, but are we seeing, deflation, or is this a general trend in? Or it's just
up and down. The reason for the sentence in this one is because of the tariffs.
Gotcha.
Because we may have to adjust pricing after we do the award for this if the tariffs go into effect on the steel.
Okay.
So we might have some fluctuation that we needed to account for, so we didn't have to.
It just seems like all of these this time are the estimates go to the
one. Yes, I want to follow your comment. So, talking about Terra, so what you do is you did the projection and forecasting just in case.
Yes, yeah, we've been working with senior leadership and with the vendors on what they are expecting. It's still really up in the air how that's going to be affected. Some saying they might do it as a surcharge. Some are just, there's so few components that it's not getting passed through. So it just really depends on the quantity and what the components are that might happen.
Thank you.
Thank No other questions? I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried unanimously. Next, item four, our CEO General Manager debriefing and study session. This item is for the board and the CEO General Manager to discuss issues among ourselves and the PD staff. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. So we've got a really good list of topics. We're going to start with our legislative update and Ryan Collins. Morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm here to provide a quick update on our legislative agenda, specifically looking at the revenue and budget discussions primarily, just given that we're getting into the last week of the 2025 legislative session. We also have Jenna Peth online, who will give a quick briefing as well when I'm done.
And this is our quick one, right?
Yes, correct. So
actually, it'll be our full one.
Yeah. So the key legislation, I want to just double check and see if you have any questions on that. Otherwise, I'll just jump right into kind of the budget and revenue, since it's kind of a fluid situation right now. So this week, legislators are working against the clock ahead of the end of session, which is this Sunday, April 27th. Between now and then, the chambers are busy concluding their work on passing policy bills while also working towards an agreement on the biannual budgets. As of this morning, lawmakers are still deliberating on the amount of revenue they intend to raise and the mechanisms to achieve it. At the same time, they're meeting in the conference committee to finalize the policy details of the budgets. Once policy is finalized, the final budget vote will be an up or down vote in each chamber. On the revenue side, budget leaders unveiled a revised revenue package last Tuesday. Notably, the wealth tax was taken off the table as it faced strong opposition from Governor Ferguson. The original package aimed to raise approximately $16 billion over 4 years, while the new proposal aims to raise about 12. The revised revenue package includes several key proposals, which I'll run through really quickly here. The first is a capital gains and estate tax increase. The proposal increases the capital gains surcharge 2.9% on profits of the sales and stocks and bonds and other financial assets over $1 million for individuals per year, while the estate tax, the exemption is raised to $3 million, and those estates over $3 million could be seen taxes of up to 35%. As you can imagine, this proposal doesn't impact the PUD since we're not individuals, so just want to leave that there. The next one is a business and occupation tax increase, which would increase the V&O on manufacturers, retailers, service providers, and certain high revenue sectors. It raises surcharges on banks and advanced computer services and adds a new surcharge on businesses earning over $250 million a year. We estimate that the PUD would be impacted by this slightly and would probably see approximately a $140,000 increase on some of the B&O we pay for services that are applicable to that tax. The next is a tax on sales tax on services and nicotine products, which would apply a sales tax to mostly IT businesses, business activities, digital services, consulting, temporary staffing services, and tobacco-like products of vaping. We are still estimating the specific impact to the PUD, but would likely see an additional sales tax on all the newly covered services by an external vendor. Next is an excise tax on zero-emission vehicle tax credits, which adds an excise tax to electric vehicle credits used by car manufacturers, but would not apply to the PUD. Last is the lifting of the state and local property tax cap, which you've seen in earlier presentations. This again would raise the property tax growth limit from the current 1% cap and then tie it to a combined rate of population and inflation and cap that at 3%. Just to illustrate how fluid this process is, just yesterday it was noted that this proposal is actually not going to be included in the proposals moving forward since it's facing additional opposition from the governor. Which brings me to the final point, and the big looming question over this next week is, where is the governor going to be at? We got a preview of this last Thursday when the governor issued a statement criticizing the revised revenue package, characterizing the $12 billion as unsustainable and ongoing with the ongoing federal uncertainty. He cited FEMA's recent denial of emergency relief funds following November's bomb cyclone and the potential for future federal cuts, warning that implementing these new taxes would be very risky. Well, it's still too early to say that we're headed towards a special session. Given the distance between where the governor and the legislature are at this moment, the odds are good. That said, never discount lawmakers wanting to get out of Olympia, particularly when the weather's so. That. See if there's any questions.
I have a question regarding that bill that's going to impact beauty, and you mentioned this 100 plus.
Yeah, you know.
So what it means with that? Could you elaborate a little bit more or put an example, I mean, for the people they are watching and listen, because when you say they're going to impact beauty, it's like, oh my gosh, they're going to increase my bill, right? I mean,
so,
that's the first thing.
Correct. So it's an across-the-board business and occupation tax, and so there are different tax. There are different services that are taxed at different rates with the BNO. We pay certain BNO taxes on specific services, and I can get back to you on a specific example. I don't have one off the top of my head, but that's going from, I think it's 1.7% to 2.1%. And so that's where we're going to see a small increase in terms of the taxes we're paid for those services. But I can get you an example of what that is.
Thank you.
No problem.
Any other questions? Thank you.
No, perfect. And I'll pass it off to Jenna, who will quick update now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jenna Peth, the district's federal affairs specialist, and I wanted to take a couple minutes today to provide an update on the status of disaster funding related to last November's bomb cyclone event and share how we're positioning ourselves in both the appeals process and the broader policy landscape in relation to disaster relief. As many of you know, Washington State's request for a major disaster declaration was denied by FEMA earlier this month. The state is now appealing that decision and has asked utilities like ours to provide additional data to help strengthen their case. We're working closely with state officials, counties, and other utility partners to fully document the impacts, both operational and financial, on our system. It is important to note that this denial isn't happening in a vacuum. The Trump administration has issued two executive orders aimed at reforming FEMA's approach to disaster declarations and federal assistance. While the implications of these orders are still unfolding, we are seeing a shift towards placing more responsibility for disaster preparedness and recovery on state and local governments, as opposed to the federal level. We are staying closely engaged in these policy discussions through our national trade associations and utility coalitions. Our message has been clear throughout these discussions: the disaster response process must remain fair and predictable. And in Washington State, public power utilities should not be disadvantaged because our disasters may not generate the same degree of damage as disasters in other parts of the country. We're also stressing the proactive investments that we have made in emergency preparedness, grid resilience, and vegetation management. And when an event does overwhelm local resources, federal support is still needed to help fill those gaps. We'll continue to advocate for a FEMA process that recognizes the real cost of these storms and ensures that communities like ours can access the support we need. I'm happy to answer any questions about the appeal, our engagement, or what to expect moving forward. Thank you.
Questions, Commissioner?
No, I'm mostly a downer on all this
stuff. Well, I have a downer too. I have a question. Maybe it'll. So is the criteria for what qualifies, is it set in law or is it agency rules?
Yeah, so the threshold is a per capita threshold based on the Stafford Act, which is the authorizing legislation for FEMA. So we did meet that threshold as a state, but there are additional criteria primarily focused on whether there's state and local capacity and whether the regional FEMA administrator can determine that there is capacity. And so we were likely denied on those grounds, but we will find out more about FEMA's considerations and what went into their denial determination through the appeal process.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ryan and Jenna. Also going to add one other update. We're going to invite our CFO, Jeff Bishop, up to share a bit of good news from Fitch, one of our rating agencies. Morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Jeff Bishop, Chief Financial Officer. Some good information to pass along regarding the annual review that we do of our rating with Fitch. We recently had our ratings revised in terms of going from stable to positive, which means in the next year to two, we could potentially be upgraded from AA minus to AA, which would be a good impact, obviously lowering our cost of debt potentially. And really, this reflects the positive work that the enterprise is doing to reduce risk. From a background perspective, we issue debt. We've got three agencies. You'll remember we've got S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. We do an annual review process just to update where our credit's at. Lauren Way and Angela Johnson have done a phenomenal job in terms of really getting out and working proactively with the agencies to make sure they understand what we're doing different in our business to reduce the risks inherent to our customers and our overall operating profile. And so with that, they really, as it relates to specifically what they honed in on, was around us moving from block and slice to load following and highlighting that reduces the amount of volatility that we can anticipate on our financials and overall from a credit risk perspective. So good outcome for the utility, for our ratepayers. And again, we really just highlight the importance of working proactively with the agency so they understand in detail what we're doing differently to reduce the risks of our operating profile. Obviously, from a long-term perspective, that's beneficial in terms of if we're able to reduce, improve our credit rating, lower our cost to borrowing, and then ultimately that, you know, we're out in the market for 30-year debt. That benefits multiple generations as we think about how that benefits our customers in the long run. So just want to provide that update in terms of where we're at and also the great work that the team has put together to get this across the line.
No questions, but thank you.
Well, there's talk about investors aren't necessarily flooding to the bond market in the current environment. But it's my recollection that public utilities are kind of in another class, and the investors are more interested in those success programs.
You know, it's been interesting as of late with what's been going on with the federal administration, and then also in terms of what's happened both relative to the debt markets as well as equity markets. We have seen originally a flood in, which was reducing overall cost of debt as we saw folks, you know, go into quality. Lately, we've been seeing that kind of waver, and we've seen some concerns around specifically what's going to happen in the bond market. Can't tell, you know, specifically where things will go. It tends to be a fluid situation, but always having a strong credit rating is a benefit. And so that's why this improvement will put us in the best position possible, no matter where we're at with what's going on in the marketplace.
But I always thought that there is a differentiation in terms of risk, that investors look to entities like the PVs more favorably than they might others.
Yeah, if you compare us to, for example, investor in utilities, we've got a public elected board with the ability to raise rates as you see fit. And so that provides a huge benefit in terms of how we're perceived from a credit rating perspective. Having that level of authority really provides a good benefit to us in terms of making sure that we can pay our investors what's needed over the course of time and make sure that we've got the rates to cover our costs.
Why local authority is so important to the study team.
Yeah.
Sometimes they try and chip away at it.
Well, they didn't chip away. Slowly, but focusing on the important.
Well, the wiggle kicking and strings.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So that's a fascinating process they have. So they upgrade you from like a full to a buy or a full positive, and then later they may or may not change our credit rating. That's just the fact that we moved to positive. Would that help if we're out of the market, even though they haven't adjusted the rating?
Yeah, I mean, the market will see that for sure. I guess the one thing I'd like to highlight is, you know, as we think about S&P and Moody's, we're AA2 with Moody's. With S&P, we're AA. We're a notch below with Fitch. So again, this was really important to get us back on parity with the other two. And, you know, really encouraging in terms of them recognizing out of the gate, hey, you're improving your business, reducing your risk profile. We'll continue to press on that heavily with them to hopefully get us to the full upgrade relative to a AA.
Yeah, I'm impressed that they understand that we're reducing our risk and it's not effective yet. So that's
well, and hats off to the team. It takes a lot of explanation to get them to that point. So
good. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And again, a huge kudos and thank you to Lauren and Angela for all the work that you all do. All right, we're going to move to our 2024 audit results, and that will be Olga Darling. Oh, Sean Hunstock is going to introduce this. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Welcome, commissioners. I'm Sean Hunstock, Senior Manager, Controller, and Auditor. Excuse me. It's my pleasure to introduce the results of our 2024 audit. Just real briefly, I want to give some kudos to staff who were involved in this process. Specifically, my general accounting managers, Tyler Wells, who is in the room, Nathan Gibson, and Aaron Ricciuti. All three of the general accounting managers play key parts in the audit process, as well as the compilation of the annual report, which is subject to the audit. In addition to them, we have quite a bit of involvement from other departments around the district, including Treasury, Angela Johnston, and her staff, as well as Wendy Paris in Corporate Communications. Much of the final product that you have that you'll see with the photos included in the report and text throughout the theme, that's really developed by the Corporate Communications staff. So they've, again, just done a very good job of putting together the annual report. And most of the kudos actually goes to the general accounting staff. Pretty much everyone in the general accounting department are involved in different parts of the audit process. However, the two individuals that really take the lead on the process are here with us today. Two lead accountants, Michael Bixler and Will Garber. If you can stand up, please. Thank you. Michael and Bill are heavily involved in the process and really lead,
thank you,
really lead the results of the audit, the final report, as well as the preparation of, we have a lot of schedules and back and forth information that go between us and the auditors, and Michael and Bill really take the lead on that. So we can take the kudos and pat ourselves on the back for a good audit result, but it's really Michael and Will that do the hard work. So kudos to them. And with that, I want to go ahead and introduce Olga Darlington. She is the engagement partner on this audit and just has been a really good resource for us for many years. And with the recent RFP process that we did last year, we'll have many more years to look forward to with Olga and her staff. And with that, I'll turn it over to Olga.
Good morning, Olga. Good morning, commissioners. Good to see you all this morning. We completed our 2024 financial audit, and I would like to share with you results of those efforts. So the auditor's report that we issued is unmodified opinion on the financial statements of the district and each individual system. Unmodified opinion translated in plain English is a clean opinion, which means that's exactly what any audited entity wants. It means the financial statements are clear, understandable, materially correct, in accordance with applicable accounting standards. So all in all, a very good report, very clean report card. We do perform our audit in accordance with government auditing standards, so it's just a notch higher than the generally accepted auditing standards. We're required to look a little bit more into internal controls that the district has in place in terms of accumulating, maintaining, and processing financial information to ensure its accuracy in the annual financial report. We did not have any findings on internal controls as well. So that report is also a clean report in accordance with those auditing standards. So once again, all in all, very clean. We did have an additional compliance audit that we had to conduct this year, and that relates to federal awards that the district receives and those federal dollars that are being spent. Those federal awards comes with strings attached in terms of additional compliance and additional reporting to those granting agencies. The total federal awards that were spent by the district in 2024 were $853,000. Of those, there was one program that was considered major, and that's the award from the Department of Energy that we had to audit to ensure compliance with the specifics of that audit. Once again, no findings in that audit. The compliance requirements were met. All of the supporting documentation to those expenditures was provided to us and audited and very supportable for the reporting to the federal agency. So all in all, good news. I say it's all in all good news, but I also like to highlight to you the efforts that go into us conducting the audit, but more importantly, the effort that it takes for the finance and accounting team here at the district to make sure that those records are good and accurate and timely presented to us. As I mentioned before, internal control environment is very important. The customers want to know that the invoices that go out every month for billings to them are accurate. And we do look into the billing of the customers, into receipts, collectability of those receivables. So cash receipts and disbursements is one area we look into closely, as well as payroll, any other payables, and administration of federal awards. Capital assets is another area where we spend quite a bit of time. The projects, the construction projects that the district takes, there's a lot of dollars added in those capital assets. So we actually make selections of those projects. We do talk to the project managers as well. So we always get out of just the accounting and finance function of the district and really talk to individuals throughout the entity to make sure that all of those processes are in good place. There was one new accounting standard implemented this year, and that's GATSB 101, compensated absences. It did require restatement of 2023 reported amounts for compensated absences, which is essentially PTO and sick leave that is provided as a benefit to employees. The accounting for that is revised a little bit, so the additional liability was reported in 2023 and 2024 compared to prior to implementation of that standard. I have to say that it's not as extensive of the new standard as we have seen in the last few years. So it was a little bit of an easier undertaking in terms of implementation. That's only one change. We are required to communicate to you other matters that we consider is important for you to know as having fiduciary responsibility with respect to the financial practices of the district. We do look at all of the significant accounting policies and practices of the district, particularly those that include management estimates. So with most of the balances in the financial statements, we're able to verify the amounts either by confirming the balances with third parties or looking at invoices, looking at billings, looking at other supporting documentation. With management estimates, we have to rely on management and their knowledge of the facts and circumstances and history in order to estimate some of those balances. The estimates that are included in the financial statements of the district are those related to unbilled revenues. So those are revenues that are provided for services as of the end of the year, but not billed to the customers until the following period. Different accruals for liabilities, damages, insurance contingencies, and such, as I mentioned, compensated absences and lease receivables and other liabilities. We do look at those assumptions that go into estimating those balances, make sure they're reasonable in accordance with the industry practices. None of these things that are listed are unusual for the district, very common for other utilities in the industry. So no findings or issues with those estimates. The audit went very well according to plan. And we set out our plan in prior to the end of the year, so in the fall. We didn't have to make any changes to that timing or the scope of the audit. So the district provided us all the preliminary information. No surprises for us during the audit. So everything went very according to plan. As I mentioned, the footnotes to the financial statements, so that lengthy narrative that goes after the financial statements themselves, we do read those disclosures, make sure they're accurately presenting information in accordance with applicable standards, understandable and clear to the readers of the financial statements. We are required to report to you if we have any disagreements during the audit with respect to any of the transactions, application of accounting standards, or anything else. I'm pleased to report we did not have any disagreements with management. We worked very, very well together. We did not have any audit adjustments as a result of the audit, which is very important. I always want to highlight that the information that we were presented for auditing was very accurate. We really tried to find something just to make sure that we are checking all the boxes, but we didn't. Management did record one adjustment that relates to the change in methodology in accounting for leases. You may remember a couple of years ago, a leasing standard was implemented. It was very complex, very challenging to implement. So management refined its accounting methodology for leases, which resulted in reducing the lease receivable balance by $10 million. It was just the balance sheet true up, if you will, for 2023 that didn't get reflected in the financial statements, but is reflected going forward. We are not designing our audit to find any illegal acts or fraud or anything like that, but we are required to report to you if we notice anything as part of the audit. And I'm pleased to report that we did not identify any suspicious activity, illegal acts, or non-compliance with laws to report to you today. So no negative report there. I would like to confirm that Moss Adams is independent with respect to the district. This is very important since we're issuing a report of independent accountants on the financial statements audit. And upcoming new accounting standards, I'm not going to go in a lot of detail in those. CASB continues to issue new standards and very active in getting those out. The good news here is these upcoming standards are primarily disclosure related, so additional footnote disclosure, not so much a restatement of prior periods or adjustments to the financial statements or numbers. And in conclusion, I wanted to echo Sean's compliments to the team here at the district, the finance and accounting team, as well as everybody throughout the organization that we talked to during the audit. Everybody was very helpful, willing to answer any questions, provide any information for us, being very open, letting us complete the audit timely. So thank you to everyone.
Questions for over from the top?
I have one question of clarification, and it's like 7 is that required communication. The second point is the district is subject to potential legal claims. That, what is that means? Could you clarify that?
It means, yes, like any other business entity, the district may receive claims against it, whether external or internal, that are generally handled by the general counsel or external attorneys. So what we do as part of the audit, we evaluate those potential claims and make sure that if they result in potential additional liability to the district, then that liability is recorded in the financial statements. Or if it's not estimable to be recorded, then it's disclosed in the footnotes. And the footnotes 12 and 13 kind of address that those instances that are able
to be. Thank you.
Yeah, very similar to the quarterly litigation report that we provide to you. There's a letter dialogue that goes on between my office and the auditors.
Thank you for the clarification.
Well, see any questions?
No.
No, I'm just impressed again with the whole organization that you perform so well, and I know it's a lot of work. And I appreciate that we are over to on for the auditor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you, Sean, Olga. We do appreciate the partnership greatly. Next up is an update on our Everett to Delta 115 KV transmission line, and Aziz Haq. Good morning, Aziz.
Great.
Hello, commissioners. Good morning. My name is Aziz Haq. I'm an engineer in the Transmission Engineering Department, and I'm here to share just an update on our Everett to Delta 115 transmission line.
The
purpose of the presentation is to just give an overall status of the project. It's informational only. Make sure everyone is up to date. So this project is it's a brand new transmission line, 115 kV. It's between our Everett substation and Delta switching stations. This transmission line was, the need for the line was identified from a transmission study that was performed and conducted on the entire system, PD system. It's to meet the load, drastically increasing loads that have been forecasted, but it's also to meet the new requirements from North American Electric Reliability Corporation. And so this line will help us be in compliance with those requirements. Just some high-level project information. I know some of you are aware of this already. There's also a map here on the left that shows the selected route. And I'll go through that in a second. So the project schedule for this transmission line, it was initiated back in 2023 with a route study where we hired a consultant to come in and identify a couple different route options. And from that point, or at that point, we also started early coordination and did some outreach with utilities. 2024, we began our community outreach. Very, very preliminary design. It was something that we could share with folks to give them an idea. 2025, this year, we've kind of hit the ground running with outreach, trying to just be transparent with the public and you all to make sure everyone's on the same page. We're hoping, you know, obviously this year we need to hit the ground running even quicker now and get going on design and permitting stages. Next year, 2026, we would begin our easement acquisition and starting to order some material for the project. Finally, 2027, we would begin construction. The line has an in-service date of the end of 2027, so we need to be wrapped up by then. Getting to the picture here on the left, this is a map of the selected route. So you can see Everett substation there in the south end of the photo. And I'll just run through this real quickly. The line is proposed to leave the substation from the east, sort of where the transit center is. We would cross the railroad tracks and then head north Hill Avenue and Fulton, where we would then head west on Everett Ave. And then finally, we would head north on Broadway, where we would eventually find our way to Delta switching station.
I'm on the slide. So actually, I remember when we first came out with this, I think there's three options.
Yes.
And there was some concern from the public about some of the options. Does this address those concerns? And what was this one of the options?
This was, yes. So this was from the beginning, the Broadway route was one of the initial options, along with a couple other routes, mostly residential routes.
Yeah.
And so those were the routes that the public were not fans of. And as you remember, we hosted an open house last year where we got and asked for a lot of that feedback. So most of the feedback was in support of this route option.
Okay.
Selected.
One other point. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. How many people participate for business?
I want to say we had at least 100 feedback forms, at least that I saw via paper or emails or social media comments. But as far as the actual attendance in person, my guess would be maybe 50 people.
Okay, thank you.
And I was just going to highlight it. We started with three options at the beginning, roughly. Mm-hmm. Then through discussions, one primarily our conversation with Mayor Franklin and her team, I think we ended up with 7 or 8 different options that were all explored, or at least some of those, you know, little nuanced routes to those. So the team has done a really thorough due diligence to really explore all the different options and come to a good conclusion.
Thank you, Jeff.
Follow-on question on routes. Was this the least expensive route?
This was not the least expensive route.
That's what I could call. Okay, I don't want to go beyond that.
And just to add to sort of the need of this transmission line, the line is to serve the entire county, the district, the system. But in addition to that, it's also going to be serving the greater need of the city of Everett. We know that the city of Everett is growing very quickly, and there's a need for two new substations to be installed. And this line will serve at least one of those substations. And it's an opportunity, Everett being as growing as quickly as it is, and this line going right through the heart, we're going to be working very closely with the city of Everett, collaborating, making sure we're all able to grow together, same page. There's a couple of milestones here since we started the project back in 2023. I can run through this list pretty quickly here. As I mentioned, the route study was started in 2023, June of 2023. We reached out to utilities in October of 23. We held our first open house January of 24. And then we did our first commission briefing in February of 24. We then met with the city of Everett, the mayor, in June of 24, where we shared the project and the different route options and asked for feedback. At that point, following that meeting, the route study was formally completed July of 24. Shortly after that, we were able to drive all of the route options with our construction team, the superintendent and our general foreman, to get their feedback. We had a follow-up meeting with the city of Everett, which I'll touch on in the next slide, along with community transit. We presented the project again to the PDELT. And then finally, just back in January, a few months ago, we met with the city of Everett again and the mayor to kind of share what direction we were going to head in. And the route was selected in February. Sorry.
Before I forget it, I did have a question. I don't want to go back to the slide, but of course, easements are always a key
yes.
in terms of the schedules. Does this have a pretty extensive number of easements required?
Yes, I think it will. Fortunately, I think, or unfortunately, however you look at it, it's most of the easements are going to be specific to the pole locations and not necessarily the entire line.
Okay.
And that's because most of this line is going to be in the right of way.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to go with steel poles, things that will hang conductors over the roadway. And we're hoping that will aid in us being able to acquire easements a little.
I don't know if this is a proper question or not, but this growing and being prepared for future, and it has to do also with the light rail that is coming to Everett as well.
I can't really speak to that. I don't know if this line will specifically support light rail. But I would imagine there is a connection there.
Thank you.
And then, Sound Transit is part of the utilities that we're coordinating with in designing.
And Commissioner Altman-Morano-Crosby, you mean from a loan perspective or from an infrastructure perspective?
Both, because they did and they have in Lynnwood. And I remember they did a lot of work in the 196. State and everything in order to prepare to connect and with the light rail expansion and all that in the neighborhood. So that's the reason I asked. So,
yeah. Good question.
I think there's a lot of growth north of the city along the river that's sort of pretty much hidden from view. So I can imagine a lot of that industrial growth is part of this load at this point.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is also just right along Broadway with their density plan. They have plenty all along that corridor.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to go outside of your presentation, but
thank you. So this some of the meetings here are worth noting, or worth discussing a little more about, and those are the ones with the City of Everett Community Transit. So I'll start with the City of Everett here. We met with them We've been talking with them pretty frequently. The meeting back in September of 24 was the first time where we were able to kind of share a potential design to give them ideas of what something would look like along Broadway. And they were very receptive to that. But in that meeting, we were able to kind of come to an understanding of what things are going to look like or what they're hoping to see along Broadway. So we were able to discuss things like aesthetics. We were able to discuss community transit, as they also have a project more or less along the exact same alignment as our proposed transmission line. The next meeting we had, which it was with community transit, naturally, and we were able to share our project's preliminary designs. And we understand, being that we are going to be more or less in the exact same area, we're going to have to work and collaborate pretty closely.
First pilot.
Yeah. We do know, at least at this point, we will be building before them, which is nice, but we, nonetheless, we'll be working very closely. And then the last meeting we had, which was key, and that was the one just back in January, we met with the mayor of Everett again and the team, and we were able to share the Broadway route with them and kind of address any high-level concerns that they had. Discussed community transit, and we discussed construction mitigation options. They had some great ideas. We also kind of high level discussed aesthetics, right? We want to try and beautify this transmission line as best we can. I know it's kind of a beautification and transmission lines don't always go together, but it's an opportunity for us to try some new things. It's
beautiful.
Yeah, right.
No, I've said before.
Yeah. Right? They each their own. Yeah. And I like it. But, coming out of that meeting, some of the feedback was, and some of the things we shared were, we can consider painting these structures differently, right? We can look at maybe using decorative steel arms, something a little easier to the eyes, maybe vinyl wrapping, a couple feet of the poles. So there's some options we can look at and consider. It'll be new for us, but it's an opportunity. We want to make sure everyone is in agreement with the poles.
Would we be breaking new ground in terms of the industry?
We could, in our creativity, we may a little bit.
Yeah.
But we want to be good partners and to try to make this as aesthetically pleasing as possible.
We also have to look at the cost of
it. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The other thing I would point out, and Aziz hit on this a little bit, but one of the concerns that was teed up in the meeting with Mayor Franklin and team in January was the impact, given this is the chosen route, the impact to businesses. And they know that's going to be a primary concern from folks that are operating the businesses along Broadway. And the team has come up with a good plan on construction and how to partner again with community transit, but also our construction process to try to mitigate the impacts to the businesses.
You probably have Commissioner Crosby, some experience with that, with the construction on 44, in terms of impact.
Okay, that's all.
So I'll be looking to you.
Okay.
Questions.
So for us, the project team, some next steps. We're going to continue working closely with the City of Everett Community Transit, making sure we're in alignment. We have the Energy Block Party coming up this weekend, so we'll be attending and we'll have a booth set up to share the project and invite folks to come and learn. And we'll also be hosting an open house on May 7th. That open house will be from 4 to, I believe, 7:30. It's a pretty big window, but we're trying to get, all the folks along Broadway to come in and share their input and concerns.
I have a question. For the open house, I don't know, thinking outside the box, are you going to provide interpreters? Yes. Just in case if somebody appears, the English is not primary language.
Sure.
Thinking about Broadway, they have a lot of business. They are business owners. They have different ethnicity.
Right. And so that's a good question. So we're working with Kelly Stickney, and I believe we're going to have some sort of, if you'd like to speak.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It's a good question.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kelly Stickney, Lead Communication Specialist Engagement. Yes, so we're really happy that we've just introduced new technology to the district. It's an iPad that allows for instantaneous translation in a multitude of languages. We're going to have these at this event so that folks can, regardless of the language they're most comfortable speaking, have a good conversation with our engineers and members of our line departments. We're very excited about that. We're also going to be canvassing the neighborhood, especially focusing on businesses along Broadway. We're going to bring those devices along that journey as well, so that we make sure that not only are folks able to communicate with us when they get here, but that they're aware that this event is happening.
And do you have any flyers that you post, or where do you post this open house invitation?
Yeah, so immediately following this meeting today, we'll put out our press release, which will go on our website. We're also mailing postcards today that will go to everyone within a 1,000-foot buffer of the proposed line. And then additionally, we're doing the extra canvassing. And then folks that were not able to reach by the canvas will also get a phone call from one of our business service representatives. So we're hoping that, we're also sharing this information with the City of Everett so they can use their channels as well.
And last but not least, are you going to add in the press release if you are not, if English is not your primary language? We are so happy to help you utilizing XY platform.
Well, we can absolutely make sure that that's included so that folks are aware of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sophie. And I want to commend you for outstanding outreach plan.
Thank you.
Really, really very good.
Ms. Kelly.
So moving, just, you know, on that note of outreach, Kelly's been great and her team has been amazing. So we're looking forward to this the next few weeks here. In addition to the open house, we'll also be meeting and reaching out to the neighborhood associations listed here, Riverside Delta, Northwest, and Bayside. And then, you know, naturally, I think I mentioned it earlier, but just start with the design as soon as possible. And with that, you know, we typically would survey this route, So a survey of that nature is definitely going to be something that you'll be seeing here next few weeks for approval. And then generating a list of parcels to start contacting folks regarding easement acquisition as needed. That's really all I have. Are there any questions?
Questions for coming?
No, thank you.
You know, just want to say thank you for working with our partners, multiple meetings with the city and community transit, and the great outreach that we have done and we have planned.
Yeah.
So thank you. This must be an interesting, as an engineer, an interesting project.
You
care so much about how your transmission
looks.
It's
been a roller coaster, but it's some good learning experience.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Great job. All right, next up is our 2025 through 2026 insurance renewal. And Colonel Kyra Farmer present. Good morning, Kyra.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Kyra Farmer, Manager of Risk Management here at the District. So I'm here today to provide you with an overview of our current insurance program, give you an update on the market, and then also show you the preliminary premium estimates for the upcoming policy term. No actions needed today, just a briefing, but I'll be back in 2 weeks with a resolution requesting your authorization to renew the expiring policies. And then at that time, we'll also have our close to final premium estimates. As a reminder, EL7 requires that we maintain the following coverages you see listed. So excess liability, $15 million per occurrence, auto, property, crime, and cyber. And you'll see in our program chart here in a few slides, we do have that and more based on district operations. So this is just an overview of our insurance renewal process. It's typically a 6-month process that starts in January, but this time around, we wanted to explore some alternative risk financing strategies, which require a little bit more of a head start. So we started in November this year of our initial discussions with our broker. Then we progress through the renewal process that starts in January, where we're collecting lots of data from all the different teams that you see across the bottom.
So in some form or fashion, RISC is reaching out to these groups to complete applications, provide information for parts of applications, and then also provide lots of supplemental documentation that are required for those applications. So huge shout out to Grant Lilly on my team who helps tag team that whole process with me. I would not be able to do it without him. It's a huge lift. Also want to shout out Angela Johnston. That's my manager who looks at every single application before it goes out to the market, just a second and third set of eyes to make sure that we're going through the application with a fine tooth comb. She has a lot of operations experience because of her time here in the district. So sometimes you need someone to kind of look at it from that perspective to see if there's information that might be missing. So it's definitely a joint effort. Before we move on, I actually also want to shout out to Kevin Johnston, who is our IT security team. The cyber application and surveys are huge, huge lift, and his team is always diligent and timely about providing that information. So I want to shout out to his team as well. So here's our current insurance program. I won't go through each tower, but you can look at each block as a representation of a coverage and or policy type. So just as an example, if we start with property there on the left, you'll see that we have a quota share policy, which what that means is those six insurance carriers listed below that share that $400 million in limits amongst them. And then there's some other information as you go across as far as our self-insured retention, our liability program where it's right under the signature, then we have our workers' comp policy, directors and officers, cyber, which we'll talk about in more detail here shortly, employment practices, fiduciary, and crime. So now we'll talk about the market, and this sort of will help inform the numbers that we're seeing in the premium table coming up in a couple of slides on what kind of premium we're looking at for the upcoming policy terms. So rate increases are slowing and they are stabilizing for certain coverages. So cyber, D&O, and property as a few as an example. Persistent severe weather events, that's not new. That continues to be have a huge impact on the market, which is going to impact how much capacity is out there from insurers, and then also how much they're going to charge us for that capacity. Then we have social inflation, impacts the market, nuclear verdicts. As a reminder, nuclear verdicts are verdicts that are $2 million and over. Those are on the rise as well. Insurers are being forced to become more creative with some of the insurance products that they're offering just because they have to keep a balance of making sure they're charging appropriate premium to pay those losses. But they also want to make sure that they have enough to pay those losses and don't become insolvent. So we're in this interesting period where us as the insured, we're looking at other options, which we'll see on the list here shortly, but it's also forcing those insurance carriers to do the same to make sure that they can retain their business. Cyber. So utility cyber attacks are up 70% year over year compared to 2023. The good news is that this is an example of how the pendulum can swing both ways. So last year we talked a lot about how the district has a positive loss history, which means zero losses. But how we see our insurance rates go up and up and up each year. And so we had a discussion last year where we were talking about how what happens in the market is going to impact us as an organization, even though we may not individually have losses. But this is an example where cyber, the market is actually softening, but utilities are still a hot target, and specifically public entities. But because the general market is doing better, we're actually getting a better rate this year around for our existing limits, and what I'm going to propose is additional limits here in a bit. So that just shows it can go both ways, where while we are a hot target, because the overall market is doing better, we get more favorable rate. Okay, so this is something I also showed last year. Just gives you an overview of the high dollar natural disaster losses that took place last year. So there were 27 natural disasters that exceeded $1 billion in 2024. You can see the breakout there listed. Something important to note is last year the count was 28. But the aggregated amount for those 28 losses was $90 billion. And as you can see this year, that has doubled. So we transitioned from this point of focusing on frequency, and it's more about focusing on severity, which severity is the part that's most unpredictable. Frequency, you can sometimes project based on history, but projecting the severity of a loss can be a little bit trickier.
A question about this. I was going to ask a question later about. So I'm wondering first two things. If FEMA pulling back impacts the insurance market, I know for us, the things that FEMA provides coverage is things we don't have coverage for. But I'm also wondering, especially looking at these, you know, storm bars and the yellow bars, the cyclone bars, is this all losses, like including things that FEMA covers in the nation, or are these just losses that insurance companies are covering?
Oh, good question. So my understanding is that this is global losses, regardless of who's covering the losses. But let me double check that for you and circle back. But I'm almost positive this is a global number. Yeah.
And then it's probably premature. Do we know if FEMA sort of withdrawing a bit from coverage, is that affecting the market cost that we might be paying or others?
Great question. That I'm not sure of. I would need to coordinate with our grant coordinators to work with FEMA a little bit more closely. And I think they can give me some heads up about what direction they're coming from. And then I can also check with our broker.
Yeah, you don't need to. I just was curious.
Okay.
I understand. Because it could make them.
Yeah. Well, we've just been hearing over the last, a few years, that so many things that happen external to us.
Yes.
Tornadoes and hurricanes on the East Coast, fires and California are impacting our insurance market, and you seem to be a little, when you look at the map, we're definitely in the riskiest area.
Thank you for asking that. Yes, that was my mind as well.
Angela Johnson, management. One of the things that I think we will definitely feel is a reorganization, right? If we're asking for recovery on losses from FEMA and we're not getting those, we might therefore ask for recovery from the insurance carriers. We're a different entity in that we're self-insured. So we start off paying for those maybe high frequency, low dollar things on our own. And those higher losses, we ask for recovery from the insurance carrier. And that's gonna be different all over the nation. But you can imagine if recovery is coming or not coming from somewhere, it's going to reorganize itself in general. And we're just gonna have to see that play out.
Yeah, it'll have an impact. These dollars are the total amount of destruction, not just specific to electric infrastructure, right?
That's correct.
Because my understanding in the IOU world, they don't get FEMA. And they don't insure against hurricanes and storms and rebuilding their infrastructure. So, but this is the dollars that is driving the insurance that we pay and or other utilities will pay.
That's correct.
Yeah. Which is an interesting dynamic. It's not about just the dollars for the electric infrastructure.
Right. And I guess I always thought that like our pole wire distribution system weren't covered by our insurance policy. So,
yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying.
We really don't have any coverage.
Right. If FEMA's not paying, and in the IOU world, they raise rates.
Yeah. Am I incorrect about that? Do we have some coverage for?
We do not have transmission and distribution line coverage because it's cost prohibitive. So as Angela mentioned, if we got to a situation where coverage for that is needed, it would fall under our self-insurance program.
Thank you.
And so this is the same data, it's just spread out to show you where it happened in the US. Okay, so this is a list of some of the options we explored for this upcoming policy term. I won't go through each one, but if you would like to know more about how we explored each one and what the outcome was, I did write a white paper that we can provide to you after this meeting. Captives were, there's a couple of different types of captives. I don't know if you're aware, but there was a House bill that was submitted to allow PUDs to utilize captives. It was not allowed before, and that bill actually just passed. And so I'll be working with government affairs to look at that language and see how that's going to impact the district going forward to have captives as an option.
Sorry, what are captives?
So captive is where you as a company create a separate entity to handle the insurance. You pay the entity directly the premium, and then the entity covers your losses. So it gives you more control over the insurance program, how losses are paid, and if there's a profit, it's retained that profit.
So is that entity for the public in our industry, or is that by the government?
We would have to create a new entity that would be domiciled in Washington to qualify.
But it would be not just P&E, all of the utilities in that class.
Well, that would be a pool, so that's similar. But Captain would be us doing it as a single parent, meaning it's just the Snohomish P&E and an entity that's created. But there is discussions with Kearns and Aegis where that is the case, where we would pool with multiple PUDs together and have to work the same way. So I think you're thinking of pulling the PUDs together.
That's a different thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so this gives you a preliminary view on what estimate we're looking at or what premiums we're looking at for the upcoming policy term. So we have a 5.073 number. We do expect that to go down. So as a reminder, our policy period is June 1 and June 1. And so our broker is negotiating these rates up until that expiration date. So when we come back in 2 weeks, you should see that number shift just a bit. And then as we get closer to May 31st, it should go down again as well.
Just to confirm, it's May 13th they're going up.
Oh, May 13th, apologies. That's when I'm returning.
Slide.
Yeah. Excess liability. So we sort of covered this. If you see the marketing efforts across the bottom, those are the bulleted lists that I've shown a couple slides ago. All of those different options, the captives, the member cells, those are all related to excess liability. So as a reminder, we have a $2 million self-insured retention. Then we have a $35 million policy excess. And then we have a $15 million policy on top of that excess. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that the cyber market was stabilizing and we get to benefit from those softened rates this year. So this is actually an opportune time to purchase additional limits if necessary because of the stabilization of the market. So what we had our broker do was we have them conduct a benchmarking exercise. And so what that entails is our cyber team within the broker group, they look at our peers and determine if we're an industry standard. So what they determined is utilities that are falling in the revenue bucket that we fall in shows that a $10 million limit is more appropriate than the $5 million that we have. So if we go back to the table, that 43% increase for cyber, that's actually doubling our limit. So when you look at that pricing, that's pretty good to go from $5 million to $10 million. So that's what we mean by the market stabilizing, where this is an opportune time to increase those limits. These are some of the things we're going to be looking at as we go into the next policy term. So our current broker agreement does expire December this year. So we will be working to secure a new agreement by the end of this year, starting with an RFP in the summer. We're a part of a couple of industry organizations that I'll continue to participate in, just staying up to speed on the market and seeing what other utilities are dealing with at the time. Underwriting engagement is really important, and that's just an opportunity for us to share more about the PUD and then give them an opportunity to ask those questions about risk mitigation efforts and loss control. We'll do a program limits analysis that'll go across the entire program, and then, like I said, now with this new House bill, we'll be able to continue the exploration of the captives. And that's all I have for you today. So again, we'll continue to negotiate those prices as we approach May 31st, and we'll be back on May 13th to get your authorization to buy and renew those policies.
Questions, Commissioner?
I don't have any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just that on page, where is it? Page 12, under excess liability, the last item, the last sentence, standalone pollution liability. Can you give me an example of what that is?
Yes. So in an effort to save on premium, sometimes what you can do as an option is to pull out a particular coverage from one policy and have it stand alone to reduce the premium on the policy that you pulled that coverage from. So right now our excess liability program has different subsets of coverage that sit under it.
Okay.
One of them is pollution liability. So sometimes you want to explore pulling out a certain exposure to see if you can get overall reduction on premium.
So then you don't cover that, you don't cover that, what you're pulling out then?
You cover it, but under a separate policy.
Okay,
correct.
Just an observation, we do have some audience today, just to know that every year this has been going up significantly and largely driven by events in other parts of the country, natural disasters.
Yes.
So it's an alarming number, but we're used to seeing it. And I guess the other thing is, I've mentioned this before, but you know, I've had a very positive experience with this public school risk pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might be interesting at some point to see if there's an opportunity to, for some elements to, I'm assuming other public utilities, PUDs, city utilities in our state have already looked at,
history.
Lost history. Yes, that's the word. History, play history. But just be interesting to know as the rest of the nation goes up, is there a way to isolate ourselves from hurricanes and kind of things?
Oh, you're talking about on the national level.
Yeah. The other thing is a risk pool, at least the one I was worked with, wasn't just insurance. It was actually had steps to improve the performance of each organization that was a member of it and gave monetary compensation to do those kinds of things. So it's sort of a way to lift everybody up to a higher standard. So,
yeah, with other parts of our business, the risk pool has been, we haven't joined it, but that has been considered. What I've seen is there are a couple of utilities that are the big dogs in the game, and sometimes then they get stuck with subsidizing some of the others. And so that's something that I was looking.
Yeah, we have to really go into it with I.
Yeah, no.
Such a thing.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to follow up on was, remember, GIST is the primary insurance carrier for utilities in general, and so that is multinational. So we don't have a whole lot of opportunity to go elsewhere, but in these, you know, standalone type policies that Kai was referring to, the insurance carrier is having to get more creative, slash other carriers are coming up to try to fill the need, or you just might not be able to go forward any longer with a particular product. So as things get more volatile or uncertain, the market comes up and meets us where we're at. So Kyra's doing a really good job looking out there and keeping her eyes open on anything that can help us, one, reduce risk, but also keep the premiums to the appropriate level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Kyra and Angela.
John, why don't we take a short break? It's 10:22. Let's go back at 10:30.
Brief.
We are back.
All right. Next is our water supply update and Scott Richards. Good morning, Scott.
Morning, Scott. Welcome. Good
morning, commissioners. My name is Scott Richards. I'm a lead hydro scheduler, power scheduling department. Last time I was here was October 22nd, and I'm here today. For anybody who asks what a hydro scheduler does, it's my job title. I have an analogy that I'm a maestro, where the 31 federal hydroelectric dams are the orchestra and the hydro palace.
Good. Yeah, they've got some beautiful music for us today.
So for our topics I'm going to cover today, I'm going to cover district-owned hydro resources, a slice product, water supply forecasts, the water supply regulation, flow profile of the water, also the monthly slice generation. I've got 9 slides in total, so I've got 20 minutes allotted. There should be plenty of time if there are questions.
as far as district-owned hydro resources, this is a table that covers July 1st, 2024 through March 30th, 2025. Pool resources here, all hydro resources, Callahan, Hancock, Young's Creek, and Jackson. From a precipitation standpoint, the range of precip in that time frame, 86% in low end of average, 92% on the high end of average. And this is precipitation is measured is snow and water equivalent, so it doesn't differentiate between snow or water. Right where snow shows up, it's counted at time. Callaghan, Hancock, and Yams Creek, the similarity there is that they're run over river hydro projects. They range in maximum generation between 6 and 8 megawatts, so relatively small. Their generation, as far as the percent of average, ranges between 110 and 132%, so above average generation output, whereas the precipitation was below average. So it's a little weird that they're opposite sides of average there. Since they're on a river, they can't store any of the water. So I think if you got a month's worth of water equally spread over the month, you might get 30 days of generation. Whereas if you got all the water in a single day, you probably get 1 day of generation. So the skin and how the water shows up compared to the actual generation you're going to get. Then the far rightmost, Jackson, it's our biggest hydroelectric project. It's a storage resource, so it can store the water. Percent of average generation there is 81%. And there's a snow survey done in the end of April, not the end of March, last month. There was 74 to 85% depending on that particular snow site. So below average. So the takeaway is just below average precip and below average snowpack when measured.
The snowpack is the recent snowpack, and the generation is the past year, well, not quite year.
Correct. The snow is a single instance in time that was the end of March.
Right. Okay.
Now, switching gears a little bit to the PPA, the site spot. This is power that the district receives currently. It's a 5% share of the Federal Columbia River Power System. That 5% share ends up being between 300 and 500 megawatts on a monthly basis and varies over the year. For perspective, that slice 300 to 500 megawatts is about 10 times larger than any of the district owned hydro resources in terms of averaging megawatts. And then middle bullet, October 1st, 2025, the district will switch from the slice block to BPA's low default product. And because of that, future water supply updates will have good focus on district owned hydro resources. So slice one or the equation like that. The line on the slides, the 2025 water supply forecast is currently below average. This chart that I'm showing, Box and Whiskers, it shows a water year starting on the left side, or the horizontal axis, October through April. And so that's the start of the water year, October 1st. And then on vertical axis, it's a water volume. That's being forecast, the new box and Mr. Bot shows up each day. So this screenshot, April 2nd was the purple arrow. April 2nd was the most recent forecast. What we see as the year progresses is the whiskers narrow down, showing a tighter range in terms of forecast. The other thing to note on this graph is the green line is a 30-year average. So the purple arrow is below the green line, showing the per teacher in the box that. As far as a percentage, that purple arrow is at 90% of average. If we now focus on the table, 2025 is labeled as middle of the table, 90% of normal. So below average in terms of water supply. And then the other
entries in this table show a link of the last 77 years, the highest and lowest years in terms of the water supply forecast, and then also 2020 to 2025. So I think that what pops out at me at that table is the last 2020 current have either been close to average or below average, been no stellar above average water years.
So can you remind us when the water year starts and ends?
So for these purposes, October 1st is the start of the water year, and then it goes through September 30th.
Okay, so October 2024.
Correct, okay. It's October 24th. This is a picture of the Columbia River watershed, the Dalles Dam. How this is, well, I'll explain that the Dalles Dam is how the purple circle on the left of the graphic. So what's significant about that purple circle is that it's the second to last dam on the Columbia River. So it's kind of an aggregator for the whole Columbia River watershed. And why this slide is up there is because the water supply forecast that we looked at on the previous slide, that's where the Dalles Dam is, where it's measured. So just putting on a map where that water supply forecast corresponds to. While we're looking at this slide, the red dots are some of the federal hydroelectric projects that make up our slice generation. Yellow dots are non-federal hydroelectric projects. Seven states in Canada, a good portion of the water that we get through the Dalles Dam originates. A quick refresher on water supply regulation. So the hydraulic regulation disconnects the inflows into a dam from the outflows. The regulation is provided by a reservoir behind the dam that will do the store of the water. It's said another way, regulation in this context is just reshaping of the water over the year. The Columbia River is regulated both weekly, monthly, and yearly for purposes of flood control, fish, navigation, irrigation, and of course, power generation, one of the most important buildings in the district. This shows a flow profile over a water year starts in October. There are three different water years shown here. Water year 2023, purple, water year 2015, orange, and then the current water year 2025, which is green. What this is showing is depending on just because you know the volume of water that you're going to get for precipitation over the year, there's still uncertainty on when you're going to get it. For example, the orange trace, a lot of the precipitation came through. So it showed an early peak in the year, peaks in February, whereas typically May or June peak and flow is more typical. It's showing the green trace during October through March. That's pretty similar to what your figures for that's on the graph. Just looking at the graph, you can guess where the generation is going to be compared to 2023.
So how attenuated is this? This is the last dam in the system, and obviously how each dam above it is operated impacts the timing of when water, when we see a jump up, does that mean that there was purple in May? Does that mean a month before there was a lot of rainfall upstream, or what? How do we put this in context with what the weather is and snow will?
In general, typical year, you can store, the federal Columbia River system can store about a third of the volume. So when you see a big jump up, it could have came from a spot that couldn't be regulated, or that they're making progress with the reservoirs and just can't regulate anywhere. another thing to look at on this chart is when you understand the flows, like particularly in July through August timeframe, the intent of the regulation is to have steadily increasing from July and August timeframe. So if you understand that intent, it helps you estimate a lot better of what plots are going to do in that. So now, similar graph, still water here on the horizontal axis, flow on the vertical axis, but I added a table of average sus generation. October through March 2023, purple trace, 2025, current year, are pretty similar. The traces go back and forth on top of each other. Now where current water year departs from 2023 is in the future, like March onward. The reason for that is we're getting a higher water supply forecast, more volume, more water. So where that water shows up is in April through August timeframe. So in the future, the green trace shows generally that more typical shape for Vermont. And why it's typical is because I don't know of anybody that knows better than what's typical. You basically need to know the temperature, where it's going to be able to put warm water thoroughly, or need to put cold on, and delays. But table, the grayed out months, April through August, there's virus built for fish. And all those months. So it was the purple trace, March versus April. The generator, the flow is actually going up, but in April, I'm trying to figure the generation went down. It went down in April because the requirements start spilling for fish. So you spill for fish, it will generate less. And that's generally the case all throughout this. So if I had to characterize this, good, bad, neither. Bad part of it is this year is below average, but the good part of it is this year that we're in, water year 25, it's not as bad as last year, which is 2024, there's a water supply. Water year 2024 is even worse than what we're looking at. This is my last slide.
And I have a comment regarding like the good, bad, when compared this year with the last year. So saying good or bad, in what position, I mean, we are, that may difference if the water, the level of the water is less compared with last year.
So the level of water is less. We're forecast to get more water than we did in 2024. So we're also forecast to get more, or if you compare historicals, we got more generation this year than last year. I think maybe tying it all together with Peter and Garrison's Peter's presentation. In my mind, it's not necessarily where the water year ended out. Was it, are we planning for it? If we're for a below average water year, like it did so far, then it turns out okay.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
I will be quiet. My bossy thing is engaging, so I'll be quiet.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Great job. Next up is our energy risk management report with Peter Donhauer. Please, Janet. Hey. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Peter Donhauer, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management. And just want to acknowledge Felicia Nang, who was
also a part of this presentation and prepared some of the data and the analysis. So back there.
And before you start, your section red pages are stunning.
Thank you. I promised
a good section. I read your presentation, but for some reason I go back and remember that.
I don't think those count against the actual slide limit, so I feel empowered to
just like
some nice pictures
there. There's
all right. Okay, today we're going to talk about the energy risk management report. So thanks, Scott, for giving us a water update. This is going to fit in nicely with that. Looking back the last 6 months, this presentation is informational only. Can I move? There we go. It's informational only, so there's no decisions to be made here. And we're going to go into a little bit of what the energy risk management program is, some of the principles there, and then really have this sort of retrospect in the last 6 months. We've had a lot of meetings. This is a list of them going back to 2021. We had a workshop, and we, in 2022, moved to a biannual risk report. We had quarterly risk reports previously. The last one we presented here was in last October. So I already went through the agenda, so I'm just going to zip through here. This is a lovely scene from a fantastical version of Mars.
The seventh, yeah. Sorry.
All right.
So now I really know Peter's gifts.
All right. So I've got everyone in a good spot now for the routine here. So as far as background on the risk policy, what we do is we make our best efforts to anticipate both our consumption of power by our customers and the supply available. So we then engage in transactions to make sure that those customer needs are met in a dependable, safe, responsible manner. And these transactions we do include buying and selling and scheduling of electric power, options for electric power, and other energy commodities as necessary to meet our load and to mitigate our risk. As far as our key strategies, what we do is we're constantly updating, defining our uncertainties and risks related to our resources and load demands. We are constantly updating our market price expectations and forecasts and acting accordingly. We have previously looked at 36 months ahead. As we now go into load following, where we have a sort of limit there. We're looking up until the end of the slice block slice regime. That brings us up to September. And we try to keep our monthly positions near neutral in the short term horizon there. And we do that by keeping our exposure to market prices below the limits that we set. So they're set at a limit that would impact us to a 3% rate increase. We try to reduce the risk from within month balancing. So just a reminder what that is once we get into a month, the variation we see in supply and demand, as well as prices, can be a little bit more volatile. So we try to reduce that risk that we see. And then we also do transactions of our market operations over time to start averaging out those kind of market variations. We use a tool called GlidePath for that. In terms of sources of risk, I'm going to just kind of go through here. Feel free to stop and ask questions as we go through. This is just a review of what our risk profile kind of looks like at a high level. So we've got a box and whiskers chart here, and this is showing both resources in blue and load in red. And we'll see our resources have a seasonal weather-based variation comes to slice and also wind. So we see a lot of that. For our load, we also see a kind of winter peaking pattern. Our load's going up in the months there. And we regularly are revising these forecasts and updating it when we have new information. We change our expectation as we go along. The box and whiskers is helpful kind of to see the gap between that red and blue. And, you know, even if it's not, the line itself, kind of where the range of that box and whiskers are, we can have some months where there's quite a big gap. And if you look at June, that's telling us that you have quite a significant amount of resource there during runoff. Whereas, you know, loads are generally well below. However, you can see some outliers there that are pretty high. But if you look at the winter periods in particular, those kind of center of the bars, they overlap quite a bit. So those are the periods where, you know, we might need to depend on market. We prepare accordingly.
Peter, can you remind us the dark circles and the shading of them, what those represent?
Those would be outliers that are outside of the 90th and 10th percentiles. So instances of, in this case, we can take March. If you look at the blue walks and whiskers there, we see some fairly low numbers for resources that are outside of that range.
Thank you.
We also have price variability, and market prices can vary significantly during a month. Recent years, we've seen higher volatility. Overall price levels have increased. This report, you'll see that actually last 6 months, that hasn't been the case. But generally, given this variability, we try to avoid, depending on the market, when prices are extremely high. That's hard to see on the graph there, but those winter months there, extending into March, so that's 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, ends of the graph, sort of highlighted in red there. And those were the months, if you remember just the slide below, where there's a little more overlap. And so we have a higher likelihood of being a little bit shorter than we'd like. And so we carry extra resources into the month to cover those situations. You can see also that the y-axis, that scale here, those outliers can be pretty significantly different from where most of the market price values are. So again, those are really the ones that we try to avoid. So now let's have a look at how things went through the last 2 quarters, last 6 months, Q4 24 through Q1 25. From a resource perspective, so Scott told us about the hydro. This is adding a little more value, or a little more detail into that. What we're seeing is a daily chart of what our resources produced throughout the periods. And that's accompanying the table up at the top there. See, overall, our supply was a little bit lower than we had planned for. Those values are actual versus planned, right? And that really held out through every month as we look through it. So until March, we had a little bit higher supply, and slice was down, kind of in line with the numbers that Scott already showed, seeing some slightly higher than planned in February and March, but really October through January, a little bit lower than planned. From a wind perspective, we see a lot of variability. Overall wind was higher than planned, 108% of what we expected. And Jackson as well was slightly lower than planned, with February being a bit of an outlier. We can move to question.
I have a question. What are all the resources?
So this would be our small hydro and our small resources.
Okay, thank you.
So purchases are part of other?
Purchases are not included in this.
Okay.
Looking at the other side of the coin, this is low demand. This is what our customers are demanding throughout the same period, and you know, this is really going to be quite related to temperature. And so we see two lines here. The orange, reddish orange line is the temperature graph that corresponds to the right hand side y-axis, and the load itself is the blue bars that corresponds with left-hand side axis. Again, this is showing over time on the x-axis. And it's showing a little bit of budget, or I should say actual versus planned. And you can see that, you know, from a temperature perspective, we cool down all the way through to December, and then start warming up ever so slightly in January. It seemed like it took forever this year. And we had our kind of cold, extended cold period there in end of January through February. And as a result, we can see that corresponded pretty closely to what we saw our peak weeks are. That cold snap that we had, you look right above on that blue bar. Sure enough, we had our peak load during those weeks. That actually also corresponded with a peak market price week. Get those in some more detail. Overall, our actuals versus budget, we had slightly higher loads than we had assumed in our budgets. And when we also forecast our loads, we do so at different periods. And we do a forecast in the middle of the month, and we also do a forecast for at the end of the month, looking at the next month. So when we look at that that month ahead forecast, on average, we nailed it. So good job, Felician, for building the model that did that. There's some variations. Some months were better than others, but overall, what we're looking for is kind of a plus or minus 5%.
It's fascinating to look at those two curves together and see where temperature doesn't necessarily drive load to some extent. Or sort of looking at that between November and December, the big peak was very nimble in the low temperature, and then it's fascinating.
I think temperatures and will explain quite a lot of that. However, you're right that some things are just patterns. They can be days of the week, they can be holidays. There's different explanations for that.
I don't like Bristol slaves, Dan.
That's right. Hopefully their LNE is right.
That's a sincere idea.
Not yet.
Oh.
They won't last forever. All right. So here's a look at the market price history. This is also really interesting. I know there's tiniest of lines there. So what's important is not necessarily to look at every single point there, but to just kind of see that, mostly it's down near the bottom, right? But then there's these spikes that occur from time to time. And to make it a little bit easier, I drew the last 6 months prices in a little bit thicker, the thickness there, the sort of thick salmon color. And you can see there that over the last 6 months, we really haven't seen much of, too much variation when it comes to prices. We'll zoom in on this in the next slide. Looking at some of the past years, we saw these big variations, August, September. These are the sort of heating events that occur in the summertime that are pushing up prices all over the West Coast. And 2022, we saw quite some big deviations in the wintertime. Coming into 24 as well, we saw big deviation in January. I think we remember that event. It would be the MLK weekend. And just to mention, these are day ahead and real time prices, so just kind of showing both profits there. So over the last 6 months now, let's just zoom in at this and look at the day ahead pricing and real time pricing that we saw. The general headline is didn't see too many deviations, but just so we can say, okay, well, what is a big deviation versus a not so big deviation? I drew in some. A bit of a probability key where, if the price gets into the red zone, that's like saying that's a 1 in 50 occurrence. It usually doesn't happen very often. But we did see 1 point in February, the day ahead market got outside of those range. So it's very, very high price at that moment. But most of the time, not really even getting into that orange range, which is 1 in 20 occurrence. So that's good. It's nice to see prices not blowing up too much. So what happened during our peak week? This is some looks at that. So our peak week, load week is during the last, over the last 6 months, is that that week which had the single largest low demand, and also shows some market prices during those periods. We had our peak hour, 7 a.m. on February 12th at 1489 megawatts. And prices over this week were $85. That was the peak price, $85 a day ahead and $106 in real time. And you know, compared to what we've seen in the past, this is relatively mild occurrence. You know, good to see we had been preparing for this winter since last year, and really putting ourselves in a conservative, strong position. And, you know, it shows we were often, you know, in a very good position, didn't have any excursions. But we also do some risk tests to evaluate how much value is at risk. The test we do is called financial load imbalance test. And this looks at our open positions. That is, if whenever our resources are not equal to our load, we have an open position. This is typically when we have long positions, meaning we have prepared for having more energy available than we will need, and we expect that we're going to be selling that off during the month in question. And so each one of these dots you see on this graph is looking at one of those risk tests. Now, we do this almost on a daily basis whenever we update our risk model. And so the x-axis is looking at forward months in our risk horizon. So if we were looking at today, right now, the risk test, we'd see a dot enter in there for N1, the month just ahead of April. So we'd be looking at that, that would come in as May, the M1 position. And we compare this against a risk limit.
I'm so sorry. What is open position?
So open position is in any position where our load does not match our demand, our forecasted demand.
Okay, thank you, because I don't even know that. And I don't know if the people that are watching and listen, they know what is open position as well. So thank you for good.
Sure. So you need an open position opportunity to sell power. Is that right? We have more energy than we need.
Typically, that is the case. We can also have an open position in the other way, where we do not have enough power for what we expect to need. Although we as part of our principles, we carry a little bit extra going to every month so that we aren't caught short when we get into that month. And that's what, yeah.
Thank you.
But as you can imagine, having a larger open position and the price of that power changing over time, and the uncertainty of knowing whether or not we will actually get that once we get there from a resource and a demand side, means that there's risk. That's the risk that we're trying to evaluate here. We did have some exceedances, and so these would be months where that risk was higher than the value that we set for our limits. You can see that these typically were in the 3 to 8 month range, and these exceedances happened because we held enough that we held this length in order to make sure that we're meeting our target. So we are keeping that additional length. If the value or the size of that goes over this limit, we prompt the question, should we reduce that limit to, I should say, reduce that position to get under that limit? And in these cases, we didn't. This has to do with going through the winter and trying to make sure we're on a conservative posture. Any questions, Tony?
I'm actually.
I saw a questioning look. It's a.
I'm
okay. We also do a another test called a price exposure test. And so this looks at our long and short positions that we have. And we simulate what a market a change would be through prices. So we simulate, we look at the volatility that we see in the energy markets, and then we simulate that in the direction that would not benefit us, and we look at the potential loss from that. Again, we compare that to risk limits that we have set. And so each dot that represents one of those tests, you know, tells us how much of that remaining limit is available. So we want to see that below that 100% line. And in fact, we saw no price exceedances in this period. As I said before, unlike what we've seen in the last couple of years, these last 6 months, we've seen relatively lower prices, which helped this test, and relatively lower volatility, which also helped this test. So any questions?
Questions?
This is so complex. I'm glad you're doing it.
Amen.
Oh, yeah. That's very fun. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Felicia.
Great job, Peter. All right, and our last presentation is one for our administration contract and product requests. There's Lamar. Good morning, Harrison.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. We are back. You can see we've been here quite a bit with those prior presentations. Today, we are getting ready for the board to take some action on this provider of choice contract. So we want to talk through the action that staff recommend that we take. That's scheduled for the May 13th board meeting. And that'll put us on track for Bonneville's timeline that does have some firm deadlines in their processes for the PUD to meet those timelines. So we want to inform you about the staff recommendation. We want to hear questions if there are questions about that. And we want to move forward towards May 13th. So for our agenda, we'll do a little bit of background. Marie Morrison with the power supply team was just here in March talking about the current status of the contract. We'll do a little refresher on that. Talk a little bit about the product consideration. We will need to select a BPA power product in our contract request. And we'll talk about our staff recommendation. So just as a refresher, right, Bonneville is obligated to offer contracts to public utilities like ourselves in excess of our resources, things like our PUD, hydro, and things like that. And the PUD has been Bonneville's single largest power customer across that regional dialogue contract. We expect actually to be a larger proportion of our power supply once we convert over from the block slice power product to the load following product in October of this year, moving from about 80% and then on the water year to about 94%. We will change products this year. And just to jump to the headline, our staff recommendation is to stay the course with that product into the new contract. Start October 1st, 2028, so 3 years after we make this switch to the load following project. We have until the middle of June to make the formal product in contract request to BPA, but the sooner we do it, the sooner Bonneville can begin drafting our individual contract. That gives us more time to review and make sure it's appropriate. We have a great team, including David Green, our new attorney who's back here, and our power supply folks listening upstairs. But we're going to need to make sure that all the details in that contract make sense, accurately reflect our resources and our load forecasts so that we get the best overall outcome for our ratepayers. So in the contract itself, this is really ground that Marie covered on March 18th. You know, we feel pretty good about this contract. One of the big things that we cared about was ensuring that we got as much of the low cost tier one power as practical and principled. We think that we've gotten there. We're really going to be within a small percentage difference of our existing contract, which is a good place for us to be. The new rate design we've worked hard with BPA on, and that new rate design is expected to result in rate savings for us, which is a big deal. I think we're about one of 10 or so BPA customers that will get that outcome, and there's well over 100 BPA customers. So we feel great about that. One of our big motivators in changing products was access to clean capacity. Capacity is what helps us ramp up resources or ramp down resources to align generation with our load. But the load following product, we get essentially unlimited clean capacity, which is where we want to be. Through this contract and through the new product design, we don't see any major impacts to that. So that's going to be a big benefit for us as we move forward into the future. So there are different types of demand from our customers, like electrification and things like that. Last, we didn't get everything that we wanted in terms of regulatory compliance benefits. We wanted a 100% clean product. We did not get that. But we did get some moderate enhancements that'll make it easier for us to comply with CETA, which will begin as a binding program in 2030. And so we feel good about those improvements that we've made there.
I do have a question. I know what clean product is, but are we saying that the issue of grid power doesn't exist anymore? In terms of clean product from Bonneville, clean means it doesn't have any coal in it, it doesn't have any, okay. So in our contract assures that that's what we get only?
No, our contract will look in many ways the same in terms of fuel mix is our existing one. Bonneville still commits to the single system mix of whatever Bonneville has. But our capacity is coming from that system mix that Bonneville has. Bonneville doesn't have any coal in their portfolio. It doesn't have any natural gas in their portfolio.
So as we purchase energy, they'll identify whether it's clean energy. Is that correct? And or whether it's not, and will you rest to clean it up?
From a big picture perspective, that's correct. It will occur on an annual basis where Bonneville will look at the performance of the year, provide us that information that will inform what our fuel mix looks like, and then for regulatory compliance, if there's any actions that we need to take, then we can take that and do the bundle or unbundled rec markets.
And that will meet CETA at the current level and at the final level, our obligation?
The final level is in 2045, and our contract will go to 2044. So there is 1 year to figure out there, but it'll get us on that road.
Thank you.
So, from a big picture perspective for us, our customers' core needs we think are being met in this contract. We like the rate design. We think that's going to give us some day one benefits in this new contract. But we also have to pick a product for the contract. And we have very recently done a really holistic assessment of what Bonneville power product is the best for us. So in 2024, we did a 4-month analytical process with a cross-functional team. We produced 4 different studies, 3 quantitative studies, 1 qualitative study. The conclusion of that process was that load following product was going to be a better fit for us both in this next 3-year rate period, which begins on October 1st, and over the long-term period, given what we knew about the post-2028 contract at that time. We have seen more of the post-2028 contract process play out, and we now believe that there are additional benefits beyond what were measured in that process. So we think that the case is more compelling, not less compelling, to move and stay on the load following product. Specifically, the things that we think are better as this process has played out than the initial analysis that we completed indicated is that the rate design is going to result in rate savings for us. We did the math with the rate design being held constant from this contract into the next contract. We just didn't know enough to make an assumption otherwise. But what we know now is that the rate design will have a different way that it prices capacity, and that capacity pricing is driving the rate savings for us. And so that will result in lower overall load following costs than we projected in the original studies.
Is that because our profile is shaped a bit different than the profiles of other load following customers? Or?
It is. Yeah, we have a roughly 50-50 residential to commercial and industrial mix. Commercial and industrial tends to be a little bit less peaky, so that's giving us a little bit better of a load factor. At the same time that some of the math for the load following product looked a little bit better as we saw more of this process play out, the operational constraints of the block slice product and the block for shaping capacity product got a little bit worse. Just from a PUD operates the product perspective. So specifically today, we have the ability to change the slice portion of the block slice product, that product that Scott was talking about earlier, up until the hour and ramping up and down as conditions change, the market environment changes, but to make things align and get the most value out of the product. In the post-2028 contract, Bonneville's proposing that it's a day-ahead schedule. So before that day happens, you've got to schedule what that slice product will look like for every hour. Even if load changes, even if the market environment changes, you don't have the ability to revise that. That's additional risk, additional expense, and it may not work as well as we'd like it to for some of the organized markets that are coming our way. So for that reason, those products probably took a step back just from an operational risk perspective. Last, we didn't know what the block with shaping capacity product was going to look like in this process, but one of our goals is to make sure that we had access to sufficient capacity, that ramping up and ramping down that we need for load service, that would work with the Western Resource Adequacy Program, because not complying with that program can drive other costs, right? What we saw in the course of the contract negotiation, the product design, is that that was going to be too restricted for our use to meet our capacity needs, and the additional product add-ons that were possible with that probably weren't going to be as RAP compliant as we needed them to be and would create additional costs. So for us, the analysis that we did on the load following product continues to show all the same drivers for that switch, probably got a little bit better in terms of the value proposition for the load following product, but probably got a little worse for the slice product and the block with shaping capacity product. Now, we will continue to assess these other options on an ongoing basis in future IRPs, just to make sure that nothing material has changed in the market environment or from what our customers' needs are. But this is really the reason that we we feel pretty strongly that
product
we're moving to in October is also the right product for us in the new contract. And I will show you a tiny bit of math from that previous analysis, but this bigger picture perspective really is the one that forms the staff's recommendation. This is unchanged and as presented August 1st of 2024 when we made the recommendation to change products. Really what I direct your attention to is the difference between the blue dashed lines and the orange dashed lines in the graph on the left. What you're seeing there is lower cost variance from the load following product to the block slice product, right? There's a bigger range of potential financial outcomes for the district. That's one of the reasons when Jeff came up earlier and talked about the positive change in our ratings outlook from the credit rating agencies, they're seeing that too. They're seeing that change in cost variance and the increase in our ability to get revenue recovery for that. This remains the case, but I would say that now you'd probably drag down lower those costs for the blue lines based on the rate design changes. Graph on the right is really just showing the deltas between those things. And the orange bar graph shows that on a P50 or expected basis, we would expect the load following product to be cheaper overall in almost all years of the study period in this contract, at the same time that it's got a smaller cost variance as well. So for us, you know, cheaper overall, less cost variance, less risk in operations, those big drivers from this study that we recently completed are still the case for us to drive the staff recommendation. Which is a pretty short sentence of a recommendation. It's just to request this BPA contract formally for the load following product. And we'd like to do that by the end of next month in order to get the process moving and facilitate staff review of that contract.
Questions for
Garrison? I'm just curious that all these executive orders, they happen in Fennell. So I'm wondering if the contract that we are going to have with Bonneville, it won't be impacted by the decisions that happen in the White House. And I said that because I saw the news and everything, and natural gas and coal, and we are talking about here a clean product, right? So I'm just curious. If we sign the contract, it won't be impact. I mean, the capacity, the Bonneville and order to, I mean, for the executive orders, they already are in place to go through and push for the natural gas and the coal by President Trump and this. So I'm just curious, and that is bugging me. So it's like, that's the reason they mentioned that.
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a number of processes that Bonneville uses that informs how it would acquire different resources and how it would manage its operations. So just from a big picture statutory perspective, you know, Bonneville has federal legislation that authorizes and obligates it to provide power from the existing federal resources for its customers. For new resources, as Bonneville thinks about what it might need to acquire to serve new loads beyond those existing federal resources, that process needs to go through the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and their planning processes, as well as BPA's resource program. And there has to be load to necessitate any resource acquisitions. And in the current resource program, we're not seeing that drive any near-term resource acquisitions right now.
Well, I mentioned that. I mean, I don't point fingers and anything. I'm just curious because we need to be prepared. And all these terrors, they count us for surprise to everyone. And we have contracts with different countries and things like that. So that's the reason that I asked.
Good question. And you mentioned the word federal legislation. I mean, anything might significantly impact it. I mean, there's law that it will require changing, would it not, to significantly impact, like Power Act? Or,
yeah.
That's an action of Congress.
Yeah, as Garrison noted, it would require congressional intervention to make the changes that you're describing. Certainly something to be aware of.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're talking 10 years.
Yeah, but it's something that we can put in the contract in order to protect us as a PUD, having this some amendment or something like that. If we sign the contract with Bonneville, I mean, it's like we have to, I mean, no matter what happened in the White House, right? I mean, we are going to do this contract, but it's something that protects us. I'm just curious too.
Yeah.
I'm not an attorney, so I'm bringing these questions because I mean I want the best for beauty. So and with the terrorists, I mean we are going to be impact somehow. And with this, I don't know if we're going to be impact somehow in the future because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
I think in this place we are pretty well isolated from a lot of that drama going on. It will be interesting to see, to your point around the new administration's promotion of coal and natural gas generation, as to how that could impact the West-wide resource availability and resource adequacy in the future. But a lot of that stuff going on really we're isolated from as far as our BPA contract and our world here.
Good to know. And thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, it's a great question.
So, Senator Alboron's question makes me wonder, one of the concerns always is if the PMA is deprivatized. If the contracts allow it out, if not that we really have any other place to buy power from, but in this magnitude, but is there an out if the
we're back in active Congress territory here in terms of that action. But I will say that formally requesting a contract and executing a contract, those types of actions are ones that can de-risk some of that. So the sooner that we can do those types of things, the less risk stays on the table.
Haven't various administrations tried to privatize several.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen. Sorry. As long as I'm standing.
So just in terms of next steps, we'll be back on May 13th with the resolution for the board's approval that would authorize the general manager to make that formal contract request with that product to Bonneville. Bonneville would send that back to us at the end of the summer. We then must sign that contract by December in order to move on to the next stage of the process and prepare for the provider of choice contract. We're in good shape and we've got a good team to carry us through.
And Garrison, just for clarification, that's a 20-year contract?
It's going to be a 16-year contract from 2028 to 2044.
That's where I was trying to do the math because you mentioned it ended in 2044. Were they originally going to be 20-year contracts or have they always been 16-year?
I guess our last one was 2012 to 2028, I believe. So I think that's a 16-year as well.
Which is where I came up.
I always thought it was 22. I never did the math. Math doesn't lie. Any further questions for Garrison? Thank you. Thank you. It's been a long road.
Yeah. Pretty job to you and the team, Garrison. All right, that's it for the presentations.
Next, we have our CEO General Manager report. CEO General Manager, have a report?
I do. I actually had a or have a great list of items to share. First, from CorpCom, our education team attended the Spring into STEM at the Imagine Children's Museum on Friday, April 18th. The education team partnered with Natural Resources to cover an Earth Day event on April 21st at Fort Gardner, which allowed them to attend an all-day Earth Day event at the Sky Valley Educational Center. On April 9th, the Veg Management Team and CorpCom attended an Arbor Day event planting trees in partnership with the City of Everett and Everett Mukilteo Boys and Girls Club. CorpCom hosted the second Between Two Squirrels all-employee meeting last week with over 400 plus employees, and that's employees and groups, because many of the groups, especially the field groups, jump on those online as teams. Great opportunity to share a host of new projects and for the PUD to get to know a little bit more about our new CFO, Jeff Bishop. We did an outstanding job on with Taylor through that interview. Energy Resources completed a four-day shutdown of the Jackson Powerhouse, April 4th through 7th, to repair transform bushings that were deemed to present an elevated risk of catastrophic failure. I am glad to see those have been replaced. All the crews did a fantastic job on that. Also completed replacement of the cooling water pump system, which will be key to the Jackson plant operating during May through June work by the City of Everett. During May through June work by the City of Everett, which will interrupt the primary source of plant cooling water. Our supply staff, with help from the Friends in Energy Services and Legal, are completing the first clean fuels program transaction that will fund components of the district's electric transportation plan with credits generated from EV chargers in Snohomish County and Island County. Snohomish County and Camino Island. During the week of April 14th, the district's physical security department hosted a 3D workshop at the electric building led by the EISAC, a division of NERC. The workshop offered a comprehensive framework and essential tools for asset owners and operators to make informed, risk-based, and cost-effective decisions regarding their physical protection systems. It also provided justification for targeted upgrades. Third-party participants attended, including the physical security manager from Chukedge Electric in Anchorage, Alaska, as well as representatives from Boeing and other local and regional utilities. Distribution and engineering, last week, Greg Ruiz, line construction general foreman, and Andrew Flaherty, manager of transmission and standards engineering, attended the NWPPA E&O conference in Spokane. They were part of a panel discussion with the topic being partnership between engineering and operations, titled Bridging the Divide Between Engineering and Operations. The panel ended up being most attended, highest rated, and most discussed session at the conference. And I believe those two did an absolutely outstanding job. And just to give the board a quick update, we are sending a crew and equipment over to Head Island. I sent you a note the other day. That we have a cable fault, again, on the same phase that had faulted a few years ago, and that we repaired. Sending the crew and equipment over tentatively on April 28th. There are three very low tides on the 27th, 28th, and 29th. We want to expose the cable and the previous splice and inspect before going any further. We're hesitant to continue the thump due to cable, in fear of the cable, or causing further damage to the cable. After we inspect the previous splice, we will make a game time decision. We will have everything ready to go. We find the old splice potentially has failed. Salt water is very corrosive, so we are concerned and in some ways, I think even hopeful that could be. We just cannot get the radar to pick up or identify where the potential fault is. Thought we'd take advantage of the time, speaking of Head Island, to do give a brief update on a new Head Island cable project. And I'll have Colin give an update. I know he's been working with Mark Flaherty and team on that.
Yeah, sure. I can provide just a few details. So the cable that is currently in disrepair that John spoke of is what we affectionately refer to as Cable 1, which originates on the Tulalip Tribe Reservation out in Tahad Island. Second cable, Cable 2, originates in the Port of Everett property. We have procured an easement for that takeoff point to be able to put the alternative Cable 2 in place. Team has also ordered and purchased the cable, which the board approved. Anticipated delivery, I believe, according to Eric Schneider, the principal engineer on the project, is somewhere January of 2026. It's a gigantic reel that needs to be coordinated with the distribution bars. It'll be utilized. So a lot of work went on there in preparation for that installation project, which will have a very limited window of when it can be installed. Eric has done, in addition to Mark Fleury, Senior Manager of Transmission and Distribution, done a great job working with key stakeholders that may be impacted, one of which is the Tulalip Tribe of Indians. Possession Sound is a usual and a custom fishing area. And so Eric has been working closely with Jason Gobin, the Executive Director of Natural Resources there for the Tulalip Tribes, on understanding potential impacts and making sure that we're a collaborative partner. We've been working on a series of discussion points on how the installation will go, what information that the Tulalips would like to see, underwater recordings, as-builts of the actual install, and then what level of periodic assessments will be done to review that cable installation. Is it properly being silted over, and is there proper sedimentation? And then number three, kind of the big ask, is there's a fear that there could be lost fishing gear associated with gear snags in this particular cable installation. So talking about how we can partner with the Tulalips to mitigate those impacts, evaluate on a periodic basis with remote operated vehicles, underwater side sonar scans, making sure that there's a great collaborative dialogue that's going on for any potential impacts that may occur.
And then lastly, just on my end, we go to DC next week for an NWPPA ledge rally, then back to DC the following week for NMRC meetings and LPPC meetings. That is it. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for John or Colin?
Lots of cool stuff going on.
How did you pronounce Chugach?
Yeah, I'm sure I did. And I should have.
Hit the mountain range.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Oh, you know what? It's
not. Not yet, I'm not anybody.
So, did I pronounce it correctly? Not even close.
You're rushed, but I couldn't quite think
well. Yeah, well, that would be a benefit.
So, I was curious, was that an invitation, and if so, what was the reason?
Yeah, if the invitation went out to a number of
facilities. Oh, so they expressed an interest.
Yeah, it came down. I know Clark, PUD sent some folks. We had police from Everett, other local police agencies. It was a pretty good crowd, and really an honor to be able to host something like that here. I think Seattle and Tacoma were supposed to show up, and I think they had have some issues and weren't able to get here. So, but again, yeah, overall, great conference.
Next is item six, items for individual consideration. 6A, consideration of a motion accepting the fourth quarter 2024 financial conditions and activities model report. I'll call for a motion.
I will pronounce it then.
Sean Hunstuck here, who will provide a presentation. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioners. Sean Hunstock, Senior Manager, Controller, and Auditor. I will keep my presentation fairly brief. There should be a PowerPoint.
I'm sorry. My apologies.
No problem. Thank you. So this report is based on quarter four of 2024, and it really encompasses all of 24, which is the annual report that Olga mentioned earlier. This morning that she audited. And frankly, some of it is repeat of what you heard earlier today from Scott and Peter regarding water resources or the water here that the PUD has experienced both through BPA as well as our own generation and then rates as well. So I will keep it brief, but certainly let me know if there are any questions. So this presentation, again, as I mentioned, is based on audited financial results. So just to touch on that real quickly, the other monitoring reports that we present quarterly are all unaudited. This is the only one that's audited because, again, it's based on the audited activity for 2024. And Moss Adams just recently completed the audit for that year. So the results for 2024 then compared to 23, net income was down slightly, but still positive, $63 million. This is for the electric and generation systems. So there are several factors that go into that. Total operating revenue was increased. We saw generally, you'll see more detail on this in a future slide, but the retail sales kilowatt hours were relatively flat, but we did see an increase in revenue based on rate changes that happened, both BPA pass-through and as well as just general rate increases for the district. Wholesale revenue, again, we'll see a little more detail on that, was up for 24. A good portion of that related to the MLK weekend and the availability of power once we came out of that, whether to sell on the wholesale market. Operating expenses, again, there's another slide that will dive into this in a little more detail, was higher. O&M costs were up and purchase power was up as well. If you'll recall, we had quite a bit of purchase power over the MLK weekend. However, it normalized, generally speaking, throughout the year. So we only ended up 24 with $29 million more in purchase power than the prior year, despite having so much purchase power over the MLK weekend. And capital expenditures were down just slightly. The larger projects there, and again, these are project to date, not necessarily just 2024. We had North County Office, $50 million spent, total project to date. The ConnectL BMI meter installation and deployment, $7.2 million, and the Camino Island substation rebuild, $5.5 million. So again, on the operating revenue side, sales were up, retail sales were up 9%. However, you'll see that on a future slide. The kilowatt hours, again, were relatively flat. But again, the revenue was up because we had general rate increases as well as the BPA pass-through that happened. Wholesale sales were up again as well. And we'll see the difference there in terms of kilowatt hours sold and the price per kilowatt hour. And other revenues were down. A lot of the impact of that came from BPA agreements. So we have the BPA energy conservation agreement. That revenue was down by $3.5 million compared to the prior year. The BPA reserve distribution clause was down by $13.7 million compared to the prior year. So BPA just had fewer reserves to distribute starting late 23 and then into 2024. During that time period. And then we saw a decrease as well in the residential exchange program. So the total of those three contributed mostly to the $21 million decrease in other revenue. So on the kilowatt or megawatt hours billed in the revenue side, again, not a huge difference on the residential side. The rate per kilowatt hour, though, was higher, again, because of the general rate increases as well as the BPA pass-through. Not a significant change on the commercial side. Again, we did see an increase in the per kilowatt hour charge based on the rate increases. The significant difference here, of course, is at the bottom of the wholesale revenue side, with more power sold and at a higher rate, comparatively speaking. And Peter touched on this earlier as well, but one of the strategies of the Energy Risk Management Committee has been to, and the rates department as well in general, is to carry more length into each month. And what that means, just to mitigate in-month risk to the extent that we can. And one of the results of that is if we don't need it, then it goes out into the wholesale market and is sold. So that contributes also to the increase in the wholesale sales in 2024. On the operating expense side, we did see increased costs overall for the electric and generation system. A lot of that had to do with some powers for purchased supplies and materials and equipment, not just general inflation, but things like transformers just cost a lot more as we went into 2024. So we had material price increases, we had personnel cost increases as well between the non-represented increases and then the bargained collective bargaining agreement increases that happened in 2024, as well as healthcare costs increase. So all of those contribute to the increase in the O&M costs of $69 million increase in 2024. The purchased power increase, and again, we had a larger number of kilowatt hours sold in, or excuse me, purchased in 2024, and the rate was significant, was higher. I shouldn't say significantly. At times, like the MLK weekend, it was significantly higher, but on average, it wasn't a huge increase over the prior year, the cost of power per kilowatt hour. So just to dive into that a little bit more, on the megawatt hours, the power supply, and these again are costs, not the revenue side. These are district purchases. Not a lot of variability in the block and slice. We did see more power available from the slice that generally is related to a better water year. And you can see that as well as in our own district generation, we had more power available for either our internal use for our district customers or for sale out into the wholesale market. So the big driver here, or the significant change from year over year, is on the market purchases. We needed to purchase more power in 24, again, between the MLK weekend and just generally holding more length going into each month to mitigate the end month supply and price risks. So that meant that we had more market purchases in 2024.
This slide, because I often get questions. I'm not there as a commissioner, but folks know that I am, about why are you putting all your eggs in one basket? And actually, I got tired of answering that. So I kind of have that on my phone, this representation, but one can very clearly see why the significance in the cost of other of our resources compared to primary providers.
Yeah, the district generation relative to the total is fairly small. So the block and slice provide the vast majority of our power supply.
Well, and the cost, right? $34, $35 compared to the Gulf,
right?
Half.
Right. Moving on, you can see the impact of the reserve changes that occurred in 2024. So the debt management fund combining with the revenue fund, that's why that number is zero at the year end for 2024. So just combining those reserve amounts, not a lot of change in the other reserves. The project reserves did go down because, again, we're spending more of the bond funded money on capital projects. Let's see, the debt service coverage did go down slightly. That's primarily related to just changes again. That's income versus the cost of debt repayment, and so we had some changes in both of those numbers, so it tends to go up or down based on how much cash is available versus the cost of the debt service for that year. And we touched on the bond ratings earlier. Jeff had mentioned it, so we don't have a change in those just yet, but we're hopeful that we'll get some movement on the Fitch rating. And again, the megawatt hours billed and consumed, retail fairly flat, retail customers fairly flat, wholesale. We did see an increase in, and again, common theme here, we needed to buy more power related to some weather events, but also held more length in each month just to mitigate risk. So that meant that we had more power available for wholesale sales. We did see a slight decrease in our net write-offs to sales. That difference is primarily related to the $200 bill credit that was applied to customer accounts during the year. So we had fewer actual write-offs. Now, the customer did not need to be past due in order to qualify for that. But however, it did provide some benefit, of course, to many of the customers who were past due. And then you can see the average cost per megawatt hour. This is an average over all of the system. So just give some idea of how that changes over time. The new customer connections are up, but not as large of an increase as the prior year. And we're currently close to 384,000 connections for power. Moving over to the water system. Net income is up for the year by $154,000. Total operating revenues are up as well, and total operating expenses also up. So one of the things that I'll mention here quickly is we have some anomalies that that happened in 2023. So we had larger sales to the city of Arlington. They had some emergency repairs that they needed to make. So we had more wholesale sales to the city of Arlington. So that revenue number was abnormally high, the $969,000 that you see there for 2023. But that also drove up the cost of purchased water, the $4,230,000 that you see down below in the operating expenses. So one of the things that impacted both of those numbers then was the need to purchase water to supply the city of Arlington during their emergency repairs. The other thing was that we had a well that was down, a district operated well that was down for part of 23. So that also increased the cost of the purchased water. So just to kind of tie those two together. And then again, net income was up. Capital expenditure side, again, these are projects to save expenses. Warm Beach treatment plant improvements, $2.9 million, and the kayak reservoir work, $1.4 million. Those are included in the capital expenditures. On the operating or the financial reserve indicators, not a lot of changes here. We do see the project reserve number going down. As you know, we had a bond issuance for the water system, and some of those bond cash reserves are going down as the capital projects continue, and the debt service coverage has changed as well, again, relative to the net income and cash available. And no changes as well for the water system for the bond rating on those bonds. And lastly, the water system operating indicators, a slight decrease in the number of CCFs, cubic feet sold for retail, and decrease in wholesale. Again, a large chunk of that change from 23 to 24 relates to not having to sell as much water to the city of Arlington for their emergency repair that happened in 23. So that number is slightly abnormal. Water system rates per CCF, not a lot of change there. Purchased water down significantly again because that Arlington need to supply Arlington with wholesale water, but also we had the well that was down, the district well that was down in 23, which necessitated more purchases of water. Customer connections, 232 in 2024, so we're close to 24,000 connections now. And that was about as fast as I can get through it.
I have a request. I'd like to hear your thoughts. So when we do this one once a year, it'd be helpful to me to have the budget amount, like
okay.
24 budget. Would that be helpful, commissioners? It's under good to know the variance from the previous year, but I'd like to know how we came in budget wise.
I would like to have that, but I don't know, commissioner.
Also give thoughts.
Well, certainly we could get it. I wouldn't want us to misinterpret, though, the nature of the business that we're in. And those variances can be related to a number of things.
Yeah.
That don't send a bad signal.
Right. I guess my guess is that some of these different variants are for budgeted. We increase the amounts in some of these characters. And so it'd just be interesting to.
Yeah, now Sarah Bond does present monthly budget to actual reports,
right.
but the timing is a bit different because we wait on this one until the audit's done.
Okay.
So she would have presented the December budget to actual report back in January or February, right? But it wouldn't be difficult to add budget information to this as well.
Okay. All right. Are there any comments from the public regarding the monitoring report? We've raised your hand. So, you answer any questions or any questions or comments, commissioners?
I have none.
Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carried unanimously. Next is item 7, commission business. 7A, commission report. Is there any report to the engineer? Any report?
Are we ready for the block party?
Yeah.
I am. I'll be arriving late, but I will be there.
Okay. So. I hope that you're coming, right?
Somebody will ask airline. Some extent.
No.
I'm scheduled.
Well, I have a comment. Last week and yesterday, I went around to visit different sites. Jackson and Jones, and I have all the names here, Hancock, and also the operation sites in Everett, so Qualcomm. And I really want to say thank you to Scott Espar and Don Bresler and Andrew McDonald and Allison and Morgan, of course, to put these trips. We enjoyed last week. That was sunny, but yesterday it was cold and raining, but we enjoyed that too. And it is amazing to me to visit those hydro projects that we have in place. And also we went to see the cows yesterday. Yes.
That's a belly operation.
Yes, it's a belly operation. There's a lot of gas there, right? But I'm very pleased to visit those sites, learning a lot and try to digest and process, and very thankful that we don't acknowledge, I didn't acknowledge before. I mean, people, we take this for granted that you only turn on your light, right? But you don't have any idea how many people behind scenes they work, and I really appreciate every single one, and I want to say thank you and invite the public to think about it, that you conscious that the light is not provided by themselves. It's a lot of hands outside and people that working. So thank you so much.
Commissioner, did I hear you say you made it to you went to operations?
Nicole, oh yeah, we did.
We had to go to station one.
Oh, I'm
old.
Yes.
The Energy Control Center?
Yes.
They let you in?
Yes.
None of those. We used to have to knock on the door. Maybe we'd get in and maybe we wouldn't.
Yes, that was amazing.
Isn't it interesting what's behind all?
So interesting. So, yes.
And remember that rain is money.
and let's still have rain.
No, not the rain of the cows, maybe.
No, but thank you.
Any other reports?
I don't have.
I had none either. Next is item 7B, our Commissioner Bennett's calendar, which starts on page 159 of the package. Are there any changes to the events calendar? Sounds like not.
Nope.
We have item eight, our governance planning calendar. Are there any changes to the governance planning calendar?
Oh, I'm sorry, for the commission event calendar.
Oh, sorry.
I think they're going to miss a meeting in June. Because I'm going to go to the public power boot camp. It's through by the NWPBA here in Seattle.
That'll be a very good opportunity.
And I'm going to miss the meeting,
okay.
Commission meeting. So I want to say that.
I'm glad to see that.
Yes. Thank you.
So no changes to our governance planning calendar then either? Well, is there any further business to come before the board today? Hearing none, it is 12:03 p.m. and our meeting is adjourned.